Welcome back to our very own official from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, who's dropped by once again Vatican Radio Studios to answer questions sent in by our listeners through Facebook on the Vatican Radio English section page and email at english@vatiradio.va. Monsignor John Kennedy.
Hello, Emer.
This week you're going to answer questions regarding to another sacrament. We've been through the sacrament of baptism, we've been through the sacrament of marriage, the sacrament of ordination to the diaconate, and of course this week we're looking at what it means to be a priest in today's world, so the sacrament of ordination to what is also known as holy orders. So, question number one, Monsignor Kennedy, what is a priest and what does the word priest mean?
The word priest comes from another Latin term. Our listeners will be familiar that I often like to begin with the Latin term. The word is presbyter, and that means an elder. And it also comes from another Latin word, which is called sacerdos. The word priest is common in many religions, and broadly speaking, a priest is a minister of divine worship, and especially of the highest act of worship, in other words, sacrifice. In this sense, we know that many religions have, exercising more or less the function of a priest as an intermediary between man and God. In the Catholic religion, the role of a priest is modelled on Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the second person of the Most Holy Trinity, as described in St. Paul's letter to the Hebrews. The Catholic priesthood was instituted by Christ at the Last Supper, where Jesus celebrated the first Eucharist with his disciples. Another word we often associate with priest is cleric, and that comes from a Latin word, clericus or clerus, and that indeed comes from another Greek word called kleros. They're quite similar, really, and both mean the same thing. They mean a lot or a portion. An important liturgical book still used today by bishops and containing the rites for the celebration of several of the sacraments draws reference to the book of Leviticus, which describes the character and duties of the priests and Levites. Their ranks were recruited in virtue not of a free choice of individuals, but based on descent in the tribe of Levi, especially in the family of Aaron in the Old Testament, which had been called by God to his ritual service to the exclusion of all others. The Levites then were referred to as those whose lot or portion is the Lord himself. So in a similar way, those who are priests are those men who are single-minded in the service of the Lord, who, as Psalm 15 verse 5 says, "Lord, you alone are my portion and my cup. You make my lot secure."
But what are the responsibilities, the tasks, the duties of a priest? I mean, what makes a priest different from a deacon or a religious?
That's a really good question. And perhaps before we speak about the obligations that priests have, it's important to say that answering the call to priesthood must be a free response that a man receives to love God in a life of ministerial service as a co-worker of his bishop. And when we see this free response in this light, then the responsibilities that he has and the obligations he undertakes are not characterized by a spirit of burden, but rather expressions of his own inner deep joy and his love for God, for the faithful, for the church, and for those who are put in a position of authority in the church. Priests fulfill their obligations not because they want to tick the boxes or follow the rules or win points, but because they strive every day to imitate Christ in living out their vows. We have a long list of the obligations of priests outlined for us in the Code of Canon Law, beginning in the section with Canon 273. We know, for instance, that priests have a special relationship with their bishop, who who is the chief pastor in the diocese, and it's the bishop who is the overseer of all pastoral ministry for the good of souls. And in fact, that's what the word bishop means. It's one who oversees. And we're told that clerics are bound by a special obligation towards their bishops to show reverence, and also not only to the bishop, but also to the supreme pontiff, who is the Pope. Priests are then bound to undertake and faithfully fulfil any function which their bishop has entrusted to them. It's like the bishop is the person who gives the work, gives the ministry to the priest. The next task reminds us how, in the priesthood, we're all one family and we're all on the same team, having the same purpose. If you look at Canon 275, paragraph 1, it says, "Since clerics all work for the same purpose, namely the building up of the body of Christ, they are to be united among themselves by a bond of brotherhood and prayer, and they are to strive for cooperation among themselves according to the prescripts of particular law." That means the law in vogue in that particular area of the world. One of the church fathers described the beauty of the body of clergy being united to their bishop as strings, all in harmony on the same bow. I think next of priests working in various parishes and even specialised ministries, where they're urged and called each day to acknowledge and promote the mission which the laity, men and women who are not priests, each for his and her own part, exercise in the church and in the world. We think of the New Testament figure of Barnabas, whose original name was Joseph. He was one of St. Paul's missionary colleagues, and it was St. Paul who gave him the name Barnabas, which means son of encouragement. This, in short, is what priests must do in their ministry with the laity. And finally, while ministry is often local, we can't forget that holy orders to the priesthood is one of those sacraments by which priests are called to share in the concern for the church's universal mission. In the Catechism for the Catholic Church, in paragraph 1565, there's a beautiful line which says, "The spiritual gift that priests have received in ordination prepares them not for any narrow and limited mission, but for the most universal and all-embracing mission of salvation to the ends of the earth. For every priestly ministry shares in the universal scope of the mission that Christ entrusted to his apostles."
But it's a very difficult mission, the priesthood, ordination to holy orders. You, being a man who took this step many years ago.
20 this year.
So also congratulations on your anniversary.
Thank you.
Can you help our listeners understand, particularly for any men out there who perhaps are considering a vocation to the priesthood, can you tell us how the priest goes about achieving these very high and ambitious sounding goals?
You're right. And in many ways, it's like receiving and giving. Now, when we say those words, we're often used to hearing the phrase the other way around, giving and receiving. However, with the priesthood, receiving comes first. And it's that receiving that allows the priest to give widely and generously. If you allow me to quote from the first book of the Corinthians in chapter 11, verse 23, St. Paul says, "For I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you." So as priests, what we receive from the Lord, both in terms of the gift of our sacred ordination, the grace that we receive daily to be active for the good of souls, and also the privileged position that we enjoy in our parish, among our friends, among the faithful, almost as if we were the extra brother in every family, or the friend who's so often welcome at the table in so many family homes, or the one who shares both the joys and the sorrows of life with families and parishioners. All of this receiving then becomes the way in which we find the strength every day to give to others by virtue of the fact that we give in all of these moments. Priesthood is not a gift that we seek for ourselves. It's not a badge that you might collect or an honour that you seek to add to another one of your achievements. Priesthood is always for other people and always for service. It's firstly for service of God, and after that, it's for service of others. The priest, like the Virgin Mary, is the one who puts God first and his neighbour next, in this process almost disappearing in this great act of sacrifice and service. So as priests, if we strive to become linked to God and our neighbour in this, I would say, new way, we know that as priests, in leading our lives, we're bound in a special way to pursue holiness. Because that's really what people are looking in their priests for. Having been consecrated to God by a new title in the reception of orders, we then have become the very humble yet frail, but also dispensers of the mysteries of God in the service of his people. You're right when you say the priesthood is a challenge. It's also a very high calling. In many ways, we're always striving each day for perfection. We try to do this by faithfully fulfilling and tirelessly carrying out the duties of our pastoral ministry. For instance, daily mass, baptisms, First Holy Communion, catechesis to young people and other people also, visits to the sick and the housebound, the forgiveness of sins in sacramental confession, the celebration of marriages, funerals, the anointing of the sick, preaching, blessing persons, blessing their homes, blessing their religious objects, praying with people, being there to offer some guidance or a helping hand in a way that really supports people, builds them up, sharing people's burdens, building up the community and promoting peace and understanding. In short, you can summarise all of the things that we've just said by saying that the priest has the care of souls. And for this reason, we're urged not only to give, but to receive again and again. And that means for us to nourish our own spiritual lives from what the Catechism speaks as the twofold table of sacred scripture and the Eucharist. So the table of the Word and the table of Holy Communion. And even though there's no strict obligation to say Mass every day for priests, they are earnestly invited to do so. We also find in our daily prayer a source of nourishment for our ministry. It's like the force that recharges our batteries every day. And that's why priests carry out what's known in the church as the Liturgy of the Hours. You might see a priest carrying around his breviary. It's a prayer book. That's the book that he uses. I'm getting close to the end of this question. We also are bound to make time for spiritual retreats. Usually we take a week-long retreat or a six-day or five-day retreat once a year, but often I know priests who take special days or half-days during the year as well in addition. And finally, priests are urged to engage in quiet, reflective prayer regularly, to approach the sacrament of penance frequently, to honour the Virgin Mother of God with particular devotion, and finally, to use other common and particular means of growing holiness, sanctification.
My next question is a question that many people outside the Catholic Church ask, but now and increasingly people within the Catholic Church are asking, and it is a bit of a hot button topic in this day and age. Even though I think we can gather the reasons why from your last answer, I'm still going to ask this question. Why don't priests marry?
Well, as you rightly say, this was one of the questions we received at the very beginning of the series, and we did decide mutually that it might be best to answer it within the context of a fuller exploration of the priesthood. In short, the reason why priests don't get married is about a deep awareness of having been chosen for this beautiful path of closeness to the Lord, where we as priests, humble and frail as we are invited to share in the Lord's ongoing ministry. It is, as the Gospel says, like the man who goes to the field and finds the pearl of great price. He buries it again, he goes and sells all he owns, and he buys that field. This single-mindedness that we see in that man discovering the rare jewel is indicative of our response of love to God as priests. We also understand that celibacy is not a burden, but rather a gift. And a lot of people don't understand that, but to explain it, it's something that assists us in dedicating our lives more generously to God. By virtue of the fact that other people see and know the priest is celibate, that they know then in their own lives that he has given up something for the love of God. And this perhaps prompts them to look beyond their own world, look beyond our own existence. So if the priest is celibate, this points forward to something else. And it means that there must be something really worth giving up if so many priests have done this for so long. Clerics know and they understand freely that they have to observe perfect and perpetual continence for the sake of the kingdom of heaven, and therefore they're bound to celibacy, which, as I said a moment ago, is a special gift from God by which the sacred ministers, the priests, can adhere more easily to Christ with an undivided heart and are able in this way to dedicate themselves more freely to the service of the community. You could say instead of loving one person, they're given the freedom to love all people to whom they minister. And for this reason, priests are to hold in esteem, especially those groups of faithful, those associations which, having been recognized by, say, the bishop, will help them to foster their holiness in the exercise of their ministry through a suitable and properly approved rule of life, and also through fraternal assistance, which will help them to promote the unity among themselves as cleric and also the unity that they have with their bishop. In a similar way, clerics are also to refrain from establishing or participating in associations or groups whose purpose or activity can't be reconciled with the obligations that are proper to the clerical state, or that may even prevent the diligent fulfilment or the function entrusted to them by their bishop.
Can I just ask you to explain what you meant in that last paragraph? I mean, while we understand, you know, a lot of these lay associations, ecclesial movements, whose lives are also ones of consecrated laity and therefore celibacy or virginity, and they can help the priest and the priest helps them in this pursuit. What do you mean by associations whose purpose or activity are not consonant or in harmony with the clerical state?
About a year after I was ordained to the priesthood, I realised in a kind of a very dramatic way that no longer was I John Kennedy, the man who grew up in Dublin and studied to be a priest, but I was now actually a public figure representing the church. And it is initially, I think, a burden for a lot of people to come to terms with that, because in other words, everything that I did and everything that I said and the people I was with and the, maybe for example, if you won't think about it in terms of say, looking on the internet and joining different groups in Facebook or any of those things, people will always look to see, is your life, are your words, are your deeds, as you rightly say, consonant or in harmony with what the church is and what the calling to priesthood. There are various different activities you could get involved in. I kind of hesitate to think of a really, really practical example, but for example, if you were a priest who would set up a dating site for people,
yeah,
you know, to go and meet, or you were maybe, say, running a disco where it was well known that drugs were being exchanged among young people, that mightn't be the best possible use of your time.
Yes.
And it might, in fact, actually lead people away from their faith. And that's something you've got to be very careful of.
Okay, so you've explained the reason for the choice of celibacy, that it is not an imposition, it is seen as a gift among men who decide to follow their vocation to the priesthood. But doesn't that make for a very lonely life? I mean, while religious live in community and lay associations and ecclesial movements have a community, I mean, what does the priest do for company?
Well, I think one of the things I would do for company is invent an eighth or a ninth day in the week just to actually relax or do a little bit of the other stuff that I really want to do. Most priests I know are very busy people and they don't have enough time in their calendar week. Most diocesan priests I know live in a parish, and in that situation they have a house by themselves. It's a particularly Irish thing, but the church asks that some practice of common life be adopted if it's possible. It's certainly recommended to priests. I've travelled to the United States and other countries too, England, and in those two places priests usually live in a rectory with a common dining room and common cooking facilities. There's even a sitting room together where they can sit and chat and watch a bit of television. In my own country, the practice of living separately is more common, although many parishes now cooperate very closely with each other, both on a daily basis in terms of the sharing of resources and the planning of pastoral ministry. I think it's really, to answer your question, it's up to the diocese, and there's no problem about priests choosing as a parish to live together, to share the same house. It's a personal thing, really.
Another question that I'd like to ask you is about the overall life of a priest. I mean, sometimes we can hear of priest bashing or priest adoration, these two extremes, people who have no time for priests if they recognise they are priests, and others instead who put priests on a pedestal. These are two extremes, but they're often things that you have to face in your life.
It's true. I suppose growing up as a child, we would have not run up to the priest and said hello to him. We would have had a certain reserve towards him. Other people are all over the priest, and they're always seeking his company. But I think, as certainly from parish experience, when people realise that you are a person like they are, your goals are the same, you're there to help them. In fact, actually, it's the parish that remains constant. It's very often the priest who comes, spends a portion of time there and gets transferred. It's part of our ministries that we get transferred and moved from place to place. But many of the people I know still retain very fond memories of priests and are very glad to see them coming back into places. I think the whole thing of the pedestal has been knocked for a variety of reasons over the last couple of years. And I think people are seeing priests now for what they really are, human beings with a particular calling, there to serve.
A debate that often springs up between myself and my colleagues here at Vatican Radio, and indeed in with other Catholic journalists and experts that I meet here in Rome, is the question of clerics and habits. In the Western Church, we've seen over the years an almost disappearance of, for example, religious sisters wearing their habits, and of priests perhaps not really wearing the cleric or the Roman collar, as it's known. Obviously, they're not imposed on the non-priests. It's a choice that they make. But, I mean, what's your view on this, on how a priest should live his life and make himself visible or known to people?
It's a really good question. I would say that in overall terms, clerics are called to live in such a way, we could describe it as an authentic way, so as to help people primarily deepen their faith and come to know and love God. So that's our ultimate goal, to help in this. We use things, material things, like everybody else does. And so we are supposed to foster simplicity of life, and we're to refrain from all things that have a semblance of vanity. Look at Pope Francis and look at his teachings and look at his simplicity. He embodies in many ways what priests strive to do. We priests have a responsibility in terms of accountability. We're not to be absent from our diocese for a notable period of time, with at least the presumed permission of our bishop. We're also to wear suitable ecclesiastical garb or clothing, clerical dress, according to the norms that are issued by the Conference of Bishops, and according to what is traditionally understood as legitimate local custom for priest dress. In other words, we're supposed to be visible as priests, so that people, on seeing us, can then approach us if they want to. I'll give you an example. I was in Ireland recently. I go every year a couple of times, but a couple of years ago, we've been having a very profoundly sad situation involving clerics, minors, and sexual abuse. And as a consequence, speaking to colleagues, priests who are younger than me, and more senior priests too, I would say that most priests that I know will happily dress as a priest wearing a Roman collar in their own parish. But many of them told me, somewhat in an ashamed way, that they find it very hard to wear the Roman collar in large public spaces, and that particularly when they go to the city centre, they prefer to wear normal clothes so that they don't get singled out by some people for perhaps verbal attack or hostility. Personally, I understand their position, but I think we should face the people straight on. And I think we shouldn't dodge the bullet. And I'm going to tell you why. Recently, I was in the main street, one of the main streets, Grafton Street in Dublin. I was dressed as a priest from head to toe, black all the way. And I was very moved, if not even, I would say, disturbed by the way I perceived people were looking at me. We were in the middle of this crisis at the time. Some people were very hostile. Others turned their heads away when our glances were exchanged. Some people stared at me, and you could see that they had an angry expression. One parent dragged her child closer to her as I passed by. I can tell you that I was very glad to reach the end of that street, but then, out of the blue, I didn't even see him coming, but a young man approached me, and after all the negativity, I suspected, if I'm honest, that he might have been asking for money, which often happens to you when you're wearing a collar. But then he told me that he was considering becoming a priest and asked me what book I could recommend to help him discern his vocation. I was glad, in some ways, to have gone through the unpleasantness in order to make myself available to this young man, who, I suppose, because of the Roman collar, felt in some way that he could approach and ask for guidance.
It sounds like a mixture between a challenging, frightening in some ways, but rather fulfilling and wonderful calling. Do priests experience difficulties like everyone else?
Yes, they do. They certainly do. And however, I would say that the vast majority of priests that I've ever met in my lifetime are deeply fulfilled people. They're fulfilled in their lives, and they're also tremendously satisfied with their ministry. Given the chance, I'm convinced they would do it all again. Yet, while difficulties arise, sometimes in an unforeseen way, just give you an example, you could have a great day where it starts off really well with the kids in the school in the morning and you meet a couple for lunch preparing their wedding and you have a funeral in the evening, and then something can just come along which can slightly even knock you off balance, maybe even pause you to perhaps even think, like, is it really worth it? Sometimes you get that mixture in the days, but I think that most difficulties are not enough to dissuade most priests from pursuing the path which they have chosen as a priest. Now, some people do find it hard going, and we know that priests have left the ministry for a variety of reasons. Many of them decided to get married. But a priest once told me, and I'll finish on this point, he said, when describing our vocation, it was a vocation you could describe as a beautiful way of loving.
I couldn't think of a more beautiful note to finish this programme on the ordination to the Holy Orders to Priesthood for our listeners. Anyone out there who might have any questions regarding the priesthood and ordination, to send them in to us again via Vatican Radio's English section Facebook page or our email, that's english@vatiradio.va. Next week, we're going to be looking at a sacrament that is probably taking place in parishes and churches and dioceses all across the world, because in the month of May, coming out of the Easter season before Pentecost, is usually the period in which most young people approach the sacrament of the Eucharist, more commonly known as First Holy Communion. Thank you very much for joining us this week.
It's a pleasure, Imre. God bless you.